Eva.
Hi Ray, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine, thanks. I hope it's okay there in Australia. Now, on December the 24th, in fact, 2013, I got a comment on my website, which is big-lies.org, from somebody calling himself an ounce of salt per day. And after some time, we got together, and he convinced me that there's a serious issue with salt in diet, which I had previously assumed there was too much salt in diet under the influence of what I assumed were, you know, people who knew what they were talking about. This turns out not to be true. So anyway, Frank, give us a brief outline of your biography so far as it relates to salt, I suppose.
Well, my sort of overall biography is I'm actually was born in Birkenhead in England and immigrated with my family when I was 4 years of age, and was educated, you know, in I guess a working class suburb high school, and
in Australia, you mean?
In Australia, yeah.
Okay, yeah, you came from a salt area, didn't you? Was it Nantwich?
In England, no, I came from Birkenhead, but it's very close. It's part of Cheshire, which is
Cheshire, yeah.
And in fact, it was the home of what's called Sunlight Village, where Unilever started, Lever and Kitchen. And the whole basis of Unilever is to convert salt into caustic soda and soda ash and hypochlorite.
Okay.
That's where the modern chemical industry comes from.
Hypochlorite, right. That was a campaign against that, wasn't there, by Greenpeace. But anyway, you were too young, basically, to know about salt when you got to Australia.
That's right. So I did. I went to university at the time when every government around the world was making university freely available.
Yeah, they did that here.
And all these things happen all around the world. So I first read physics at the University of Melbourne, majoring in nuclear physics. Then I did undertook a short course in building design before doing mining engineering, where I worked with the largest mining companies of the world, including BHP and Western Mining and Rio Tinto.
You majored in nuclear physics. Did that ever come? Did you ever apply that?
No, not ever. There is no application for nuclear physics other than to be a teacher.
Okay.
As we've talked about, there is no nuclear physics, so there's no jobs for those people unless you want to be a teacher. It was just one of the many scams, I guess.
Okay, fair enough. I just wondered because I've got this interest in nuclear stuff, but it's not related to
so
the
far,
present.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the attraction to your website was your...
Okay, well, I'm glad you got in touch, actually. I mean, I believe you got in touch with other ones as well, but they ignored you or something. So... Anyway, whatever the reason, let me just do a summary. According to my stuff online. Oh, by the way, we have a website. It's biglies.org/salt. That's Frank's article. He wrote it. He wrote most of it. I put a bit of stuff in myself. It's actually shorter than I thought it was. I thought there was an awful lot of detail, but in fact, it's just a summary of some quite important points. As far as I can see, looking back, about 2011 was the first awakening of people to this salt issue after years and years of anti-salt propaganda in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, that's usually written. And from then, from 2011 on, 2012 and so on, there were some various people got into this act, as it were. And although they were all a bit, they all soft-pedaled it, they all had great trouble opposing this idea. Anyway, at that time, Frank emerged, and the point about salt, of course, that a lot of people don't seem to understand is the biochemistry of it. It's just needed in particular for hydrochloric acid in the stomach. Perhaps you'd give us some idea of how you became awakened to the whole issue.
Sure. So from about 1996 onwards, I was involved in the salt industry as a mining engineer, working for Australia's largest salt.
Okay, is it Sea Salt?
Yeah, the company largely used sea salt, and They also produce some vacuum salt, which is a bit...
Okay.
Go ahead.
The reason I ask about sea salt is because, of course, there is, you get salt on land as well, typically deposits which have been there for geological time, for incalculable amounts of time. And, of course, that may contain stuff. The land stuff is not identical to the sea stuff.
That's right, yeah. So the company that I work for also produces salt from inland salt lakes as well.
Okay, in Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
Right.
So the reason I became involved in that is as I became the sales and marketing manager for that company, and that there was a constant discussion about the health aspects of salt, and I would often get pilloried by my friends for working with such a dangerous chemical. And of course at this stage we were starting to sell, the Japanese salt market was opening up, and we were selling, there was a huge interest in Japan for salt out of Australia because they were deregulating their salt market, which had been heavily controlled. So controlled, in fact, that in Japan there is a special institute for salt called the Japan Institute of Salt and Tobacco.
Oh, they were grouped together as dangerous substances, yeah.
Well, not so much as dangerous substances. Well, as far as the Japanese are concerned, salt is the elixir of eternal life. Salt is such a big part of their culture. They before they have a sumo wrestling match, they will sprinkle salt out on the mat before they perform many of their rituals. There's salt involved, and salt is a very large part of the Japanese diet.
Is that sea salt? I don't know if they have land deposits.
No, in fact, the Japanese developed this quite remarkable technology called what they would do is basically bring in seawater in massive quantities and produce a kind of a concentrate.
Yeah.
They're called membrane plant technology, and these companies called the Seven Sisters were established. Each of them produced about 250,000 tons of salt each year.
Okay, this is not traditional. This is an industrial, a modern thing.
Yeah, it was a modern thing. Before that, Japanese, the whole of the Japanese culture was geared towards working out ways to get salt. Because it was so difficult for them, they and their climate was not conducive to salt. They've got no natural sources of salt.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah. Do they have things like? I mean, if you look at the history of salt, there's all kinds of things with getting brine and boiling it and that sort of thing.
All of that stuff, yeah. And it's all of that history is very important in Japan. And so, as I said, this Salt and Tobacco Institute.
Oh, I see.
It's a big thing. It's a big thing in Japan, and there are still, even after deregulation, a museum established to, about the importance of the salt industry in Japan.
Okay.
And as Japan industrialized, they then put a lot of effort into establishing salt works in Australia, in fact.
Okay. But that's traditional. It's it goes back to the Middle Ages, does it, having a salt culture? Because there's nothing equivalent to that in Britain.
As far as we can tell, as far as we can tell, it's been a long time, for whatever history there is in Japan, that salt idea has been very important.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting when you say that that's not true in Britain, because I would argue fairly clearly that it is, or was.
It depends what you mean. I wouldn't say it made a huge difference. I think salt is one of these things that is, in a sense, it's all important. It's like water. It's, if you've got it, but if you've got it, it's the importance drops away to nothing. It's very, the demand is inelastic, isn't it? You've got a certain amount. You need a certain amount, but then after that, it doesn't have a demand curve in the way that varies with price, the sort of thing you get in economics textbooks. It's an very unusual substance in that sense. But we must get on to that, actually. We must kind of explain why that is. Anyway, so...
what was happening then is... So I was observing, as a sales manager, that salt sales to animal husbandry in Australia was huge.
Yeah.
And considered to be... an extremely important part of animal husbandry, and I've been involved in the roles that I've done. I've been involved in that agribusiness for quite some time. One of the mining jobs I had was also working with a fertilizer company, for example.
Okay, and so you naturally enough assumed that if what's good for one animal must be good for another animal.
Well, one started to puzzle about what was going on, and then it turned out that my one of my relatives by marriage is a very well-known doctor in the field, and he was studying a condition called hyponatremia.
Right. Hypo, which is a condition, too little sodium.
Too little sodium.
Yeah.
And that comes about largely when people that are undertaking endurance sport are told to drink. Are told to drink a lot of water, and in so doing, they drink so much water they dilute.
Yeah, okay, and they sweat too much as well, presumably.
Well, in fact, it turns out that after much study, endurance athletes should probably do nothing.
Right.
Should probably do nothing. Although you would have heard of Gatorade.
Yeah.
Gatorade, of course, is the magic elixir that took the Gators to some NBA National Basketball Championship, which was a heavy concentration of salts, mostly sodium chloride.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, of course, and then the other thing that started to puzzle me was, why was it that the most common medical intrusive intervention is the insertion of a saline drip into people?
Okay. What did you conclude from your relative, your medical relative?
That the idea of, obviously that salt is just a crucial...
Okay, I mean sodium being, the source of sodium being mostly salt.
In fact, there is, in practical terms, salt is the only source of sodium.
Okay, so...
It simply is not another practical alternative to salt.
All right. So what was the next stage after your speaking to your relative?
Well, I simply started to, you know, investigate the role of salt and became, when I was selling salt in Japan,
yeah,
I started to realize that the Japanese have salt quantities way in excess of anything that we talk about. Some people in Japan have been known to have 90 grams of salt in a day, and of course the Japanese people also have by far the longest lifespans. And then my boss at the time pointed out to me that isn't it interesting that the graph of longevity versus salt consumption is monotonically increasing.
Okay. Well, there are all kinds of statistical problems, aren't there? I mean, you get wars and famines and stuff, and of course the life expectation is only has to make assumptions about the future. So there's all kinds of traps waiting, which no doubt are exploited to the full. You know, in compiling these figures.
Yeah. So in the end, then I started to, you know, really start to do a lot more research about, you know, what physiologically happens. I mean, for example, I didn't know until I guess I was in my mid-40s that the stomach converted salt into hydrochloric acid and that it was essential.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You'd have thought that it would be kind of generally known. I think it's something to do with the education system being not as good as it might be, that sort of thing, or being kind of routinized and given out to people who just want to make a career.
A bit like I regularly ask people, including doctors, how do you think your stomach works? How do you what do you think happens? And people just have no idea that the key component of digestion is the production of hydrochloric acid.
Yeah. Well, and pepsin as well. Actually, I looked.
Well, in fact, the pepsin is activated by hydrochloric acid.
That's what they say. I think if you kind of look at it skeptically, I think the point is hydrochloric acid, of course, has a corrosive effect on bits of meat and stuff. Not so much vegetable matter, but on meat. And the more the hydrochloric acid corrodes away at it, the better attack the pepsin has. So I think it may be a misreading to assume that pepsin is increased with hydrochloric acid. I think it's just that as the acid goes up, the effectiveness of the pepsin goes up as well. Do you take what I'm saying?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
You could be right. All I can say is that the articles that I have read on how pepsin works is that you need a certain pH before the pepsin gets activated.
Yeah. Do you see what I mean, though? That may be a misinterpretation. It only occurred to me the other day.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me just say, there was a couple of I saw a YouTube saying a cheeseburger in hydrochloric acid. There were various.
That's it.
With black kind of crap coming out of it. It was not a very good experiment. Didn't give any idea how strong the acid was, and it was done without.
I think it did. I think it talked about a pH of 1. That was something out of the University of Manchester, I think.
There is a chemist at Manchester who's quite. There's a lot of stuff on this. Jewish bloke, I think. It looks a bit with sort of frizzy hair. Anyway.
Yeah, he does look a bit Albert Einstein, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yes. Okay, what was I going to say? Oh, I ought to say actually that just to avoid getting any entanglements with bent lawyers or with people with weird idiopathic diseases, we're not medically qualified. What we say, although it's true, it may not apply to people who've got strange, ulcers or something. So, if you need medical advice, you should try and get it. But you might have a problem getting it from people who know what they're talking about. We ought to make that point, really.
Yes, absolutely. I don't pretend to give anyone medical advice here at all.
Okay.
Quite the reverse.
Well, not quite the reverse, but I mean, this biochemistry is true, isn't it? Nobody's going to get away from the raw facts of things like sodium and chlorine. Okay. Anyway, so
that's right.
So you did your research, I presume, into things like renin and the sort of things that appear on the website. Your article here.
Yeah, so then we just started to. I started to just basically read the research, and what occurs, of course, is that as people cut down their salt intake, well, let's go back a step. Let's talk about the physiology, if you like, of salt. The sodium level in the human body is the most carefully controlled of any substance.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. Can I just ask you, when you say that, you're looking at presumably massive results, population results of various things found in the blood, that kind of thing. And it could be anything.
Yeah.
And some of them vary much less than others. And what you're saying is that one that varies least,
is the sodium level, and it's controlled within a concentration of around about 1.4 millimoles, which basically means about 8 grams of salt per litre of sodium.
All right.
Or salt equivalent per litre of blood.
Let me just repeat this, though. When you say that it's controlled carefully, you're saying this is an observation. It looks like that. You're not necessarily taking a view on how it's done, but the fact is, sort of like it or not, is that sodium is controlled very, very precisely.
Very, very precisely. Okay. But what I call, in that article, I call it basically the human autonomous system. The
HASS.
The mechanisms by which your body does stuff.
Okay.
Now, what is quite remarkable about that is just how tightly controlled that is. So if people cut down on their salt, their body will do all sorts of things to maintain the sodium level in the blood. it will, and it then produces, the kidneys produce a thing called renin, which traps the sodium in the bodily fluids, but has the severe consequence of also making the blood thicker, you know, far
more granular, you mean?
What's the word? Increases its viscosity, as they say in engineering terms.
Yeah.
So it moves from away from being a fluid into a kind of a honey-like substance.
Yeah. Okay.
And that is the cause of, and that actually causes severe blood pressure.
Let's kind of pause there. Let's kind of summarize what we're both saying, which is that salt is absolutely essential. If you take excess, it doesn't matter, it will just sort of get peed out, and it's essential because it makes hydrochloric acid, which is essential for digestion. If you don't digest properly, your stomach will get bunged up with stuff and you get bad side effects and so on, and B, it doesn't, some of the food that you should get, which you eat in fact, doesn't get digested, so that the attack on salt is completely wrong. It's misconceived. You have to have salt. It's necessary for hydrochloric acid. You could, in principle, work out how much you need by looking at things like sweat. If you live in Death Valley, you're going to sweat and all that kind of thing. And but most of the salt will get excreted. Most of the salt will get converted to hydrochloric acid, and that will attack stuff in your stomach. But obviously, that will get excreted. So you need a continual feeding of salt. Is that what you're agreeing with? You're saying that?
Well, essentially, it's so fascinating, really, is that no matter how much salt I take or how little salt you take, or any person, any human on the planet, we can safely predict that the concentration of sodium in their blood will be between 135 millimoles per litre and 145 millimoles per litre.
Okay.
That is incredible.
It's incredible.
You know, by...
Sorry, it's a bit remote from the average person. I'm just saying that what you're saying is that you have to have salt, basically. There's no substitute.
Substitute for salt. And if you don't have it, you'll die. And that is openly acknowledged by every public health.
Okay. Can I just extend this a bit to evolutionary theory? The theory is that that life started in the sea. So seawater was necessary. And in fact, when life started, you were just automatically surrounded by default. You had seawater around you, and that's the body kind of assumes seawater. In effect, your body has a supply of seawater circulating around in it, in your blood. Plus, of course, you've got stuff to carry oxygen and so on. And it would not be surprising if the stuff circulating has a proposition similar to what the Earth was like, I don't know, hundreds of millions of years ago. Not necessarily the same as today, but very likely. So it has a combination of these things, and they're ionic. They're not substances in their own right. So if you get seawater now, it's often stated to be sodium chloride plus magnesium chloride and so on. It's actually slightly misleading. The seawater contains a mixture of ions, and they exist separately. Chloride, Cl, chloride ions, Cl minus, being the most popular. There's more of that than there is of sodium. So it's a safe bet that you need not just sodium chloride, but other stuff like magnesium and trace elements, for example, iodine, which are found in seawater as well. Do you agree with most of that, or some of that?
Well, look, I would... obviously, I, as you know, Ray, I don't hold to the view of evolution even slightly. However, there is a similar story told in Vedic literature of the creation of a substance called Amrita. Mm. And that substance, the story of that substance is essentially the story of shaking the rocks to put the juice in the ocean. Whatever you and I, our personal views of how it all came about, the net result is that the human body contains seawater at about one-third strength.
Okay.
I should say a well-balanced, well-nourished person.
When you say one third, you mean one third of the strength of modern seawater?
Yeah, so okay. Modern seawater is running at about 32 grams of salts per litre, of various salt, and people are running at about 8 or 9.
All right. What I want to do is start with the conclusion, which we both agree is you've got to have salt and in quite a lot of it and all the rest of it. What I wanted to know now was what your particular unique USP, you know, unique selling product, what is it that you've worked out that other people haven't or don't seem to have, and we can go through however many of these you've got, because what we're saying is something which will presumably irritate a lot of people or come as a novelty to a lot of people. What are your principal novelties?
Well, I think the principal novelty that I would say is that my principal view is that a higher intake of salt will minimize illness by encouraging, firstly, a better nutrition. And secondly, by creating a robust alkaline body system. And the other thing I think that's unique is I am suggesting that the increase in longevity which took place with the Industrial Revolution in the UK and Japan as well and various other places has taken place because of the sudden and cheap availability of salt. Which up until then had been so difficult to obtain that it was the source of, well, in fact, as we know, Roman soldiers used to be paid in salt.
They were partly at any rate.
Salt.
That's quite. Is that new to you? Is that the hypothesis that?
As far as I can tell, that view, in effect, I'm really saying the sole reason for our increased longevity is because of the cheap and plentiful availability of salt.
As far as I know, I've never heard that idea before as I can remember, unless I've seen it in passing. So that's your the McManus hypothesis, is it, that that most disease is caused by salt shortage?
I guess the basic principle is that most disease is caused by malnutrition. And in the main, malnutrition in the Western world comes from from basically not absorbing your food properly. And I think I've written it in the article, Ray, where we talk about we are not what we eat, which is the common thing. People say you are what you eat. What I'm saying is you are what you digest.
That's funny. I hadn't really, until you pointed it out, I hadn't really sort of shot in on the fact that indigestion just means something not digested. I assumed it was meant sort of a stomach upset or something, but of course you're right. Indigestion is where the food passes through, isn't, and the nutrients aren't extracted. But anyway, that is, as far as I know, that's your hypothesis. Do you think that would apply even to the sort of heavy hitters of the disease world, like things like cholera? I mean, do you think if people got more salt, their stomach would cope with things like cholera? Yeah, you did mention pylori, Helicobacter, didn't you?
So the cause of the modern ulcer has two Perth doctors won a Nobel Prize for establishing that the bacteria Helicobacter pylori was the, if you like, the cause of stomach ulcers.
Yeah, once it got in, they drilled and it's helico, it's a spiral. Do you think that would apply with cholera as well? I know cholera is regarded as being a really serious disease, but do you think if you had enough salt?
Well,
I don't know the salt situation in India. So, I would assume it's difficult to get. I don't know, though.
Well, again, salt is extraordinarily important in that country. It's a major industry. The Gulf of Kutch and all of those things, and salt is heavily controlled in India. The distribution and control, again, another one of these inexplicable items.
When you say controlled, you mean taxed, in effect?
Well, it's taxed. It's there are a certain group of people that are allowed to work in the industry and not others, and there's almost like a tribe of.
Really?
I'm not sure if they're quite untouchables, but of that kind of thing.
A sort of caste, the salt caste.
That's it. Yeah.
The same sort of image as Siberian salt miners, maybe. I do know that.
All that sort of stuff.
I do know that pink Himalayan salt comes from a set of mines in Pakistan, which apparently have been in use for centuries.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so. Well, whichever way you cut the mustard, you're saying that salt is an essential thing. It's been known to be essential, although, of course, obviously without the chemistry. I mean, nobody before about the 18th century had any idea of the chemistry of these things. They didn't know that sodium was a metal and chlorine was a gas, for example. They didn't know that salt was made of sodium chloride. But So that's fine. So anyway, your hypothesis is that.
And one of the guys that were onto this fairly early. What is that? Who is the fellow that Preston? Rice Preston or what is his name? He's a fellow that was involved in discussing the dental habits of the indigenous peoples around the world. Who said basically they don't need any dental care. They just, you know, do whatever they like.
Yeah.
What?
I don't know. I don't. Is Preston, doesn't ring a bell with me. But what's the connection with salt?
Well, essentially, he was has that same guy has suggested that salt is a hugely important part
in the formation of bones, the skeleton,
and all sorts of.
All right.
Weston Price, I think, is the name of that guy. And on that site, on the Weston Price site, again they've also started to talk about the importance of salt to the human diet.
All right, okay.
Now what is of course now becoming I guess painful is that the medical work is now showing pretty clearly that salt is the low salt message is really crazy. So there was a conference in Michigan in earlier this year where the key it's been talked about for a long, long time that the key problem with salt is it increases blood pressure. And that increased blood pressure then results in a much higher level of deaths. So if I just read the abstract of this paper published, this paper is called Low Sodium Intakes Are Not Associated with Lower Blood Pressure Among Framingham Offspring Study Adults.
Mm.
And it's number 446. And the author is Lynn Moore from the Boston University School of Medicine, Martha Singer from the Boston School of Medicine, and M. Loring Bradley, also from the Boston School of Medicine. And if I just read this abstract, which is all I can get hold of at this stage, high blood pressure is a major modifiable risk factor for cardiovascular disease. To reduce blood pressure, current U.S. dietary guidelines recommend limiting sodium intake to 2.3 grams per day for healthy individuals under the age of 50, while adults over the age of 50, as well as all African Americans and anyone with high blood pressure, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease, is advised to limit the sodium intake to 1.5 grams a day.
What's the point you're making?
Okay, I'll continue on. Very limited evidence is available to support these recommendations. Recent studies have called these guidelines into question and identified the need to consider the intakes of other minerals, such as potassium, magnesium, and calcium, in addition to sodium in relation to blood pressure. The net effect of all of this, in the end, is that people on low salt intakes actually have higher blood pressure than anyone else and have a much higher risk of cardiovascular incidents. So that even though that, And that's the only study, a direct study of people on salt. All the other studies that have been done are what's called meta studies.
Right. In other words, well, how can they can't all be meta studies, because there wouldn't be anything to study, would there?
Again, you should. It's worth following it through. But I am. They all seem to be studies of other aspects. But the point here is simply that the very first study of direct measurement of people in this Framingham offspring study of adults clearly demonstrated that low salt intake resulted in higher blood pressure, and that's largely because of the production of renin and aldosterone.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think there's much point taking single. I mean, there are thousands of papers published all the time, often by low grade medical people who don't know what they're talking about. I don't think there's much point just concentrating on one of them. We've got to look at the overall view. Anyway, your first hypothesis is that one of the most important aspects of health is salt, and that this is shown. Maybe it's hard to be fair about things. The increase in travel, if you can transport goods more cheaply, as in the 19th century with railways and so on, then this goes to show that people were healthy because of salt. That's a hypothesis to be tested. So that's your first contribution. What is the? There are a couple more. What were the couple more things?
I think the other issue is that the discussion about the immune system of the body is that a healthy human immune system has a pH range of between 7.35 and 7.45.
Okay. And that's
interestingly that pH level is the second most closely regulated aspect of the human autonomous system. Yeah. So the first is the actual sodium level, the second is the pH level maintained in the body.
I think I'm right in saying that's
that's
mostly to do with sodium bicarbonate, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of discussion about whether foods are alkaline or acid. But in fact, the way your body is made alkaline is by the parietal cells of your stomach converting salt into hydrochloric, which stays in your stomach, and into bicarbonate, which stays inside the fluids of your body.
Yeah. Well, I presume they're hydroxyl ions, and they get converted into bicarbonate, don't they? And it's a very fancy buffering system, isn't it? Because you've got carbonic acid, you've got carbonate ions and bicarbonate ions. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there.
This is where your first contribution really kicks in, Ray. Where you made just pointed at to me, well, your question to me was, does the chloride shift play a part in the human systems? Because I know it plays a part in birds. So it turns out, of course, that the chloride shift is this fundamental mechanism by which carbon dioxide is carried out of the cells and oxygen is put in to the cells. And essentially that is an interplay between the respiratory system, the breathing system, and chloride and the circulation.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead. And it also turns out that the efficacy of the chloride shift, the efficacy of our breathing, and the etc., is highly sensitive to the amount of free chloride available in the human body.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the crazy aspect of all of this stuff on salt is that even in 2017, there has still never been a study on the optimum amount of chloride that humans should have.
That's absolutely. I was very struck by that as well. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's flabbergasting.
Yeah.
All those PhDs, and yet the report put out on salt, etc., by the U.S. Federal Drug Authority, FDA, whatever they're called, they have specifically, and I think I've written this in that paper, they have, where's the effect that we don't need to worry about the amount of chloride you have because we know you're getting enough sodium. And because you're getting enough sodium, you must be getting enough chloride.
Yeah, I think the conclusion is that there are an awful lot of bad scientists around. You know, they well, it's not a joke. It's a fact that I think it's one of the reasons why you get third world doctors. You know, they don't understand the science, but they're promoted by it's a Jewish thing typically. It's part of the anti-white world. But anyway, I've got here a book in front of me, Principles of Human Physiology, from Harold Hillman, in fact, and it was first published in 1912. And this stuff has been known, like, for example, the chloride shift and the fact that the body has a lot of chloride ions in it. Most of the liquid has... I mean, it's been known for years. I think there's been a regress. It's been a step backwards in medical education. The point there, the reason I was interested in that was because it's known or believed that if the body is alkaline, you can't get cancer. Cancer cells won't live in it anyway. So that if your stomach is making more acid, it must mean that the rest of your body is getting more alkaline. And so just taking salt would be a preventative against cancer. It would stop if cancer exists there. It would not flourish. This is assuming that the alkalinity thing is actually true. It's a 1930s discovery. So that has some importance, doesn't it? As does the business of treating cancer with sodium bicarbonate. You have... Yeah. I mean, the reason...
Which we also talked about in that article, the work of the Italian doctor.
Yeah, I don't remember who it was. And I imagine... is that your kitchen?
Is my kitchen, yes. Yes.
Anyway, okay, so that's the first point you're making is your hypothesis that health is very largely dependent on salt. The second point here is that as you get more acid in your stomach, you get more alkali in your body, and that is also another effect. I don't know why that is, actually. I don't know whether it's a cause or an effect. It may be that in evolution that creatures which extruded hydrochloric acid were better defended, and that therefore the body adapted to become more alkaline, or maybe original cells, maybe small, you know, amoebas or something, have some perfectly sensible reason for being alkaline. I don't know, but the general idea we've got here is that more alkaline body is a better thing. And of course, the body is much more
only to the range of 7.45.
Yeah, okay, but I mean that's sorry. I mean, it's much more. You're talking about pH of 1 in the hydrochloric acid, which is a lot stronger than this alkalinity level. But of course, the relative volume is so great, the body is so much bigger than the stomach contents, that makes sense.
Well, it just turns out that higher levels of pH actually encourage parasites. So it's in this very strange range,
right,
between 7.35 and 7.45. So again, you know, for the sake of clarity, again, I think as other people would have heard, that I don't share Ray's view on evolution. But nonetheless, I would say that the design of the human body is quite astonishing, to the point where well-nourished bodies are incredibly tough.
Okay. That's the two things. One is the salt, availability of salt and its effect on health. The second one is the alkalinity, the keeping the body itself down to 7.5 or so pH, slightly alkaline. Okay.
Now, just before we move on, I just want to make a point about what is going on in the stomach about digestion and pH there.
Okay.
So one of the, I think, more egregious things that's going on in the world is people suffering from indigestion. And we know the word actually says indigestion. And what's causing indigestion is that the stomach is not acidic enough, so the food that is eaten is not digested properly, and then it tends to then pop open the valve at the top of the stomach and allow some of this weak acid to escape into the esophagus.
Okay.
And that causes what we call heartburn. But it also burns, the weak acid burns the esophageal passage.
Right.
A dreadful situation. And then the cure or the treatment is to give people what they call antacid, something to neutralize the stomach acid, which of course makes the problem even worse, or even worse, some these crazy things that discourage the production of hydrochloric acid. So again, this is not medical advice, but I would suggest that people that have strong indigestion should consider increasing their salt intake, and that will almost certainly eliminate their. Well, let me put it this way. Other people that I know that have made use of this idea have noticed an immediate cessation of the symptoms of.
Let me just repeat what we've been saying. If you eat a typical meal, like a hamburger, say, or something, if your acid is too weak, it just sits there being incompletely digested, and basically the more you eat, it just fills up your stomach physically, like a toilet being shoved, having toilet paper shoved into it, something like that. It's a physical thing, and then it gets to the top of the stomach and it kind of forces itself out. That's kind of essentially what you're saying, isn't it? Good. All right. Well, that's
and the difference, right, between, so if we now compare a medical textbook of the 1940s, that would discuss stomach pH levels. It would say something like, "Oh, the human body produces 3 liters of gastric fluid at the pH of 1."
Yeah.
But now they talk about pH of the gastric fluid between 1 and 4, typically 3. Now, if you have a pH of 4 in your gastric fluid, it means that your stomach acid is 1,000 times more dilute.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a
than someone with.
It's a logarithmic scale.
It's a logarithmic scale. So it is causing, as far as I can tell, this particular aspect of the low salt virus is causing incalculable harm.
That's assuming people stick to it. It's hard to know, isn't it? When I go to a fish and chip shop and they've got a salt shaker the size of a sort of pint mug or something, and they chuck it out pretty much ad lib. There's no indication that anybody there takes seriously any salt advice. So it's hard to know, isn't it? It's difficult to know how seriously.
But it's always done with that kind of, oh, we're all weak humans. It's kind of done with that. It's a guilty pleasure thing, isn't it?
Not in this chip shop. No, they just kind of bung it on. I couldn't see there's any. Anyway, let me take another point here on the tongue. You say that there's a receptor for salt. It's another issue which kind of puzzles me a bit. The tongue has receptors for, you know, sweetness and so on. Generally speaking, most of these things are chemical compounds like sugars or acids or the alkaloids, which are bitter, so you get this bitter sweetness. But there's also a salty one, and some people, I've seen it stated that the tongue tests for sodium ions, but that sounds like wrong to me. I think there's a test for ionic stuff. So if you nibble sort of potassium chloride or magnesium sulfate, all these things taste ionic. They taste different, but ionic. So I think there's a tongue receptor for dissolved ionic substances. Do you agree with that? Or maybe you don't think it's important? I don't know.
No, I think, as far as I can tell in my research, that salt is the specific thing that that is tasted of those.
Okay, do you think you get a higher,
it's,
you get
sweetness,
you get more of a reaction to for the salt? I mean, there's no question that magnesium sulfate, I mean Epsom salts, has a distinctive taste of its own.
Yes, but it's tasted as bitterness.
No, it's not. There's a definite taste of a sort of ionic taste. And put some of these salts products, you can get a mixture of sodium and potassium chloride. They definitely taste different. They taste kind of analogous, but different. I mean, I don't believe there's a distinct sodium chloride receptor. But if you do, that's fine. I'm not kind of, it's no big.
Sure. It's nonetheless, whichever way we go about it, the reality is that you are able to detect salt in food very clearly.
Okay.
Do you agree with that?
There's definitely a receptor for things of a salt type, yeah, and maybe salt gets more of a reaction than anything else. I don't know.
So I have a collection of things like sodium chloride, magnesium chloride, calcium chloride, and a few others. They all have quite distinct.
Yeah, but you
tastes.
Can taste them. That's the point. It's not a receptor. Presumably, would taste just the one thing.
That's right. So you're perceiving them as a combination on the five, what they call the five tastes.
Okay. All right. Well, never mind that. Do you have any more discoveries of your own apart from your hypothesis about the supply of salt and also the acid, importance and the alkaline points? Okay. What's the next thing?
So whether they're of my own or they're not.
Right.
So essentially, we can say that on a age group by age group basis, let's say 50 to 55, 55 to 60, 60 to 65, and so on, the number of bone fractures per 100,000 people in what I call the Anglosphere compared to say Japan.
Right.
Is it five times the rate of Japan?
So this is a thing you've noticed just in your Japanese travels.
Okay. Yeah.
How do you get to know that? I mean, do you know a lot of people who've damaged their bones?
It's something that I just, again, it came through me. I noticed the use of salt in agriculture to deal with bone deficiencies and so on. And then it just occurred to me to see what was going on in Japan with regard to bone fracture. Well, I heard that, first of all, I heard that the rate was much lower in Japan, and I have then gone out and found those statistics.
Okay.
So
yeah, I see.
It is just straightforwardly, again, denied that it's because of salt. The usual explanation is because, oh, it's because they have more fish or whatever.
I've heard the same thing said about lung cancer. I'm told the Japanese smoke a lot more than in the West, but they have much less lung cancer, although I've seen that attributed to an oily diet, but maybe there's a salt connection there.
Etc. So the attribution is that it's not to do with salt, but in fact the physiology of the human body is that excess sodium is stored in the bones. And in fact, when people have a low salt diet, and as I said, I mentioned earlier that the body will do whatever it can to maintain sodium level at around about 140 millimole, about 7.5-8 grams of salt equivalent per liter of blood. And when it does that, it actually then takes the sodium from the bones.
Yeah, I see.
So that again, my hypothesis, my direct hypothesis, is that osteoporosis in the Western world, in the Anglosphere, is entirely a result of a reduced restricted salt
diet.
Interesting
idea. I've never heard that idea. I've seen the similar things with, for example, There are various diseases like edema, where you get fluid build-up. That could be to do with osmotic pressure. That could be salt-related too, couldn't it? So could celiac disease and things like inflammatory bowel diseases. You know these things, because if you can't digest things like wheat properly, because you're, then of course you can get all kinds of crap going through your bowels. It might, you know, have a damaging effect. Ulcerative colitis and others. So all these things might be an effect of salt being too low. Isn't that the case? Have you looked into those?
Well, again, I that's exactly what I think, Ray, and to the point where, as far as I'm concerned, if people are ill, my view is that the first thing they should check, the first thing they should try is to increase their salt level.
Sounds, yeah.
But this is not medical advice.
Yeah, it's hilarious, but... Anyway, any other? I wanted to go on to a whole list of popular errors and beliefs and stuff, and all unpopular ones, or ones that the medicos believe, which I think are wrong as well. But as to your own contributions, we've had two so far. You've had the supply of salts and the acid and alkali balance. What's, have you got any more?
They'll probably pop into my head, but just generally your energy levels. If people on with higher levels of salt, their mitochondria, the way your mitochondria function is driven by this potassium sodium chloride balance, you know that.
Yeah, possibly. And there are doubts about. Let me just make a note here. I've got some stuff that came up in looking at these sites, things like sodium channels and apoptosis, free radicals, and autoimmune disease. These are all things which, in my view, this is something I derived from Harold Hillman. These are all doubtful ideas, and the same with same with mitochondria. There's doubts about them. So,
even existing,
oh, no,
is
exist, all right. It's the question of what they do. They, when they try to investigate these things, for example, mitochondrial DNA, they do a system of, in effect, they use a sort of chopping up device to cut them into little bits, and then they spin it down. They have a high high-frequency rotary thing which makes that layers, it separates things by density, but and then they assume from then that one particular level of it is taken from, for example, mitochondria, but I don't think there's any accurate basis that it should. According to their own theory, it should be sorted out on a sort of molecular weight basis. So a lot of this stuff is highly doubtful. And I mean, Hillman started with electron microscopy, which is full of errors. So I think you've got loads of teams of workers under some supposed expert, and they carry through these procedures without really knowing what they're doing. It's part of the general degradation of scientific method under the influence of money. In my view, it's a Jewish thing, very, very largely, plus their puppets. Anyway, never mind that. That's another...
Okay, so I guess the other important corollary of the salt, you know, the body maintaining a very specific salt concentration is about the level of hydration in the human body.
Oh, hydration, okay.
So the reality is that it is said in the USA that most of the population in the USA is chronically dehydrated. Now, this results in various things, but you know, poor skin, blood's too thick, and so the blood doesn't get to the fine capillaries, you know, that control hearing, touch, taste, sense of smell, and so and generally causes a breakdown in function because people are not simply just not hydrated enough.
Is this visually?
And the reason
is it visually clear? I mean, are you talking about people who look a bit sort of mummified and dried up? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Carry on.
And the reason that people are chronically dehydrated is because without having a high enough level of salt, your body has to keep getting rid of fluid to maintain a very particular concentration of sodium in the body at the 140 millimoles. So if people keep running down on very low levels of salt in their diet, it means that the volume of fluid, the overall weight of water in their body will be reduced. Yeah. Now, this is a complete no-brainer. This is, it's not, what I'm suggesting is not even arguable in many respects, and yet it's just an undiscussable. Clearly, if you're dehydrated, pure water does not help you at all. In fact, it's toxic, it's poisonous. And that's essentially the study that I talked about before of hyponatremia.
Right.
That people that are drinking water without salt are in fact causing themselves harm.
There's a, what's called a meme, water alone does not rehydrate, on this website of ours, biglives.org/salt. And you referred to an EU directive on not...
That's right.
I've seen the same thing in disasters. You know, if you want, you don't give people just water, you give them salt and also sodium bicarbonate, and that works properly. Can I just introduce another point here, which you drew my attention to the other day? There was a thing, I think it was on Facebook, an illustration saying that if you drink seawater, it makes you more thirsty and it will sort of kill you. You said this was nonsense. What's your reinterpretation there?
Well, in fact, there was a very famous French doctor in his day called Alain Bombard, who his interest was because at that time that many French sailors that were capsized or set adrift were dying. They were perishing from lack of water while they were, you know, adrift in boats and so on.
Right. Okay, makes sense. Yeah. Are you sure this is on L. Ombar and E. Brochure, 1904? It might have been that.
Oh, I wasn't familiar with the 1904. The one I'm familiar with is... let me just confirm my stuff. Yeah, Alain Bombard is the one I've got.
Well, whatever.
Bombard?
It was the year I was concerned with. 1904. Of course, that's probably the end, the ending of the sailing boat era, isn't it? I mean, before that, you had quite huge networks of boats powered by sail, and of course, they might get might be non-moving for days or weeks. So in that case, you'd be concerned with water. Anyway, go on with the seawater.
So, you know, the current view, or the view up until that time, was that if you drink seawater, because its concentration of salt is three times higher than it is in the body, that it can cause, it basically will kill you if you drink it.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, yeah.
Now, it turns out that it's not true. What Bombard proved was that if you have a mouthful of water every 20 minutes, your body is able to adjust to that and excrete the excess sodium. Now, so in the report in the Wikipedia, they talk about how the fact that there's some suspicion that Bombard took fresh water with him to supplement his journey. However, that idea is confounded when you realise that both the French and the Taiwanese navies continue to train their sailors with that particular survival strategy, and the Taiwanese have extended the exercise to 134 days.
So you're saying they drink dilute seawater in an emergency?
No, they train their sailors and have extended the training of up to 134 days where they drink one mouthful of seawater every 20 minutes.
Yeah, so what's the end point you're getting at here?
The end point is that it's not fake, it's a real, you can live on seawater.
Okay, but not too much of it in one go.
But the point is there's no fresh water involved. So for anyone that finds themselves stranded at sea with no fresh water, please don't die for not wanting to drink a mouthful of seawater every 20 minutes.
So you've got your supply of the supply of salt being better than it was as a major health influence, and you've got this acid and alkali thing. Now what's the anything else, anything more or less which you believe is attributed to you? I'm not going to investigate or anything.
No, I can only say that for me personally, I'm now 58, plus 58 years, and from the time I started to what I would consider salt heavily, my eyesight has improved. I don't wear glasses, and yet at the age of 50 I was wearing glasses.
Oh, right. Let me just introduce people to that. The idea you have there is that the capillaries at the back of the eye are very fine, and so if you improve the liquidity, you know, if you increase the, if you improve the blood's ability to move and not be granular, which is got by having more salt. So in other words, more salt improves your eyesight, in a put it in kind of simple form.
And all of your senses, your, you know, because the blood is thinner, it's able to maintain its ability to bring nourishment along those fine capillaries.
Okay. Let me now go through all this business of popular myths and so on. I'll deal with the problems. Yep. These are the things that I found by just scanning through online and looking at people's comments. Let me start with making this point about chloride. There's more chloride in seawater than sodium, isn't there? It's about 16% more. So this is why sea salt has things like magnesium chloride and potassium chloride in it. It's a kind of artifact of drying out, isn't it? In the real state, in the liquid state, they're not separate salts. But when you evaporate them, the least soluble stuff comes out first, presumably. So you get you get. It's worth.
So there's a segregation of those salts in the solar evaporation process. It's analogous to compressing air, and the gases come out one by one.
I believe you get calcium sulfate as well, which is insoluble in the.
That's the first thing to drop out.
Okay, now here's a comment somebody made. Herbivores don't have salt. What about things like horses and cows? And this is I think it was a Hindu or something said that. Horses and cows don't.
Well, in fact, the reverse is true. Certainly in Australia, sheep, cattle, horses get copious quantities of salt. It's by far one of the biggest sales markets for salt in Australia. And in fact, apparently the main purpose elephants use their tusks for is to dig the ground to get salt.
Have you seen there's an interesting video of elephants in Kenya going into caves to get salt out of them. It's quite a weird sight.
I haven't seen that, but I have been to a crater called the Ngorongoro crater in Tanzania, which is this really enormous crater where there is salt available, and inside that crater are massive amount of lions, right? And despite the fact that the animals know that they can be killed by all of these lions, they have no choice but to go and get salt from this.
I was going to ask about the state of nature. What about horses in nature who aren't given salt as a supplement? Where do they get it from, somewhere or what?
I simply don't. Okay. I don't know that. But in Australia, of course, salt is fairly easily got to in the inland area anyway.
Isn't it interesting? Sorry.
And presumably they drink seawater. Yeah.
Well, if they're near the sea, I mean, a lot of places like China and India are a long way from the sea. It's why they get iodine deficiency, isn't it? It's one reason they get goiters in these places. Anyway, never mind.
By the way, iodine is not normally found in salt.
No, of course not. No, sodium iodide. I'm saying if you've got seawater, there's iodine in the sea, not in huge amounts, in the sort of amounts you'd expect for a trace element. So if you drink...
Just to bore you, what happens is that seaweed concentrates iodine in a most amazing way. And so, again, seaweed is a big part of the Japanese diet.
Okay. Now, here's a comment which is true. If you look at the diagrams, you see cows and sheep have four-part stomachs. You know, a bit of it is done to ferment the stuff, but it's only the last part that has hydrochloric acid. So the other three bits, you might expect them to get diseases in the first three parts of their stomachs. Is that got any comments on that? Do you understand what I'm saying? It's the end point. It's as though their stomach. If we had instead of just going straight down to the stomach, if we had a whole load of other storage devices, then going into the stomach, you might expect that there'd be problems there. I mean, for example, sheep do get fluke liver. I think they're called liver flukes. They transmit an infection, possibly due to the fact that the stomachs are not acidic at the start. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I think the comment I'd make is that in comparison to humans, those animals are riddled with parasites.
Ah, well, that would explain it. Why isn't the first stomach acidic? Would that damage the other? Oh, I suppose it wouldn't do. If you're relying on fermentation, it means having yeast, I suppose, to work on them, and bacteria. So if they're flooded with acid, that's not going to help it. That's probably the reason, isn't it? Okay.
I haven't spent a lot of time on that physiology of those animals. What I do know is that salt is used on the paddocks in New Zealand as a fertilizer to assist cattle and sheep to graze. They actually spread salt out, and it has a tremendous improvement on the productivity of both cattle and sheep.
Now, here's a comment that somebody made. This is the sort of thing you get on the internet. Sodium chloride is toxic and causes stomach cancer. What would you, if that person was in front of you, what would you say, if anything?
Well, I would simply ask them, how does their stomach work? And I'd also ask them, why is it that the first thing that occurs when you go to hospital, the insertion of a saline drip.
Okay. Here's another one. Sodium chloride is processed. This is another interesting thing about industrialism. Sodium chloride is processed and denatured, and it's an industrial chemical, and it's bleached and lifeless. What would you say to that?
Okay, so there is a little bit of truth to that. We've already discussed, Ray, is that the human body has blood fluids that are similar to seawater. So, for example, in Britain, the way that most salt is produced is that there's a large deposits of rock salt underground, and pipe is inserted through the rock into that salt, and hot water is pumped down into that area, creating a brine, and that brine is pumped to the surface. But before you can make salt out of it, using machines that they call vacuum pan evaporators, they have to treat the brine with caustic soda and soda ash to remove the magnesium and the calcium, etc., so that the brine is a kind of a purified sodium chloride brine with a little bit of disodium sulfate in it. Now that's the product that gets turned into household salt in England, and then the problem is that salt produced that way is prone to caking, and so they have to put in
anti-cake. You're not really addressing the issue. There's some bloke who is worried that, or professes to be worried, that it's denatured and bleached, and
he's entirely correct.
It's a ridiculous thing to say, isn't it? Sodium chloride is something. It doesn't really matter how you get to it. It's sodium chloride. It's an absurd irrelevance.
So
you're not really addressing his issue.
Well, so the question. It's not a question, I'm quoting somebody.
It's nothing to do with me.
When he's saying it's denatured, he's obviously talking in compared to, say, salt.
Denatured is the wrong word. Denatured applies things like proteins. You know, if you boil an egg, they call it denatured protein.
I think in reasonable, you could say that he's referring to the fact that the nature has been taken out of it.
Yeah. Oh, okay, let's forget.
From a technical point of view, obviously you're correct.
Yeah, forget that. Let's go on to the next one. Somebody here says, as we age, we make less stomach acid. And that's true. Or is it just that they're eating less salt or getting fatter or something?
What I think happens in all of these things is because of the dehydration that goes on, that the certain systems break down more quickly than they should, and the parietal cells are starved of nutrients the same as people's eyesight, hearing.
That could be the case, couldn't it? Yeah. Could be the case.
So I think that that in fact is what happens as people get starved of salt, that their ability to make hydrochloric acid diminishes. Okay. I think that's quite likely. And again, I can only go on the comparison to the Japanese population, where I don't know if you've seen... in fact, that there are 60,000 people in Japan over the age of 100, yeah, which is three times the rate, per 100,000 of the USA, all the Anglosphere. Well,
yeah, I'm always a bit skeptical of these things. I mean, maybe you're assuming that their population recording figures in about 1917 were completely right. I mean, you don't really know, but I believe. I mean, I accept that that's probably true.
No, sorry, I'm not talking about that at all. I'm just saying of the current population in Japan, which is about 120 million, there are 60,000 people over the age of 100.
That's if the recording figures of their date of birth are correct. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. And in the same, you would say in the USA, of their 360 million people, there are about 50,000 people over the age of 100.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Here's another comment that somebody's made, which we've already referred to, that weak stomach acid makes pepsin less effective, and this is what triggered me to the idea that pepsin, I mean, after all, pepsin is a complicated enzyme molecule, and I'm not at all sure that the surrounding acid would make any difference to it.
My understanding is that comment is correct.
You see the point I'm making, that they probably haven't tested it. If you have meat and it's attacked by hydrochloric acid, presumably, you know, from the outside in, the inside stuff remains unchanged for hours. But the stronger the acid, the more targets pepsin have to get to work on. So it may just be a myth, an artifact caused by weak stomach acid.
Maybe.
I'm not saying it is or not. It's a possibility. Right, there's somebody here talking about the potassium deficiency scam, and he's talking about potassium ions. Do you have any views on potassium, really? I mean, there's a sort of idea.
So blood pressure is very clearly modified by increasing the amount of potassium in proportion to sodium in the bloodstream. So if you are suffering from high blood pressure, one of the simplest quick fixes is to increase the potassium in your diet.
Yeah, maybe. There's so much mythology about sodium. I thought presumably there's mythology about potassium as well. I mean, I know they used to use potassium chloride as a lethal injection, and that's probably given it a bad name.
No, that... Again, the problem... When I talk about potassium, it's not very healthy to take it directly like that.
Well,
vegetable matter, food, is rich in potassium. So clearly it's most sensible to get your potassium from your food.
I think generally, because of the way life evolved, food was taken in not in tablets or chunks or quantities of the same stuff. So probably with any... I mean, if you're going to take salt, for example, it's probably better to have it sprinkled over stuff rather than just as one lump. So
yes.
It's probably the same thing with potassium. What I'm asking is, do you think potassium has any adverse effects that you've checked on rather than just, taking it from the media? I'm interested. I'm curious whether...
So there was a thing to make a thing called what they call light salt, which is a combination of 50-50
That's right. Yes, that's correct.
Potassium chloride and sodium chloride. It's generally, my understanding is that it's considered quite risky.
Yeah, but that's what they would say, isn't it? I've just wondered if you checked into it.
Yeah, I haven't. It's a really good question to find out if it is a... another scam or not, isn't it?
I just don't know. I'm not enormously bothered. It's not because it's relatively a rare thing. Okay, there's somebody in a comment here on the internet was saying, quotes, toxic amounts of potassium iodide. See, these people are so fucking stupid. They've got no idea of the quantities involved. But I think, again, I think that's probably derived from using iodine as it used to be used as a, you know, a medical thing, to an antibiotic. So people assume that, I mean, you know, they assume, so perhaps they avoid iodized table salt because of that.
Well, again, I would suggest to people strongly that they are, if they're likely to be deficient in iodine.
Absolutely, go for it. Right, here's another one. It's clear that the average daily intake in developed countries far exceeds what's needed for survival. That's just a kind of meme, isn't it? It's something that's repeated over and over again.
Yeah. So again, on the basis, I would simply argue that. We are not seeing any evidence at all that high salt level, what people call high salt levels, is injurious at all. But we do know that low salt levels is definitely injurious.
When you say we know, you mean a few of us know. I mean, presume there are a lot of people who believe that stuff.
Yeah, okay, so,
anyway,
so
not
let me
clear.
Put it another
clear way. That the average daily intake far exceeds what's needed for survival.
Far from it.
Here's another comment that you get quite a lot of, this sort of thing. I'll read three of them here. New Guinea Highlanders' average daily salt intake is around half a gram a day, and there's no evidence that they are unhealthy. That's number one. Here's the second one. For several million years, human ancestors ate a diet that contained less than 1 gram of salt a day. And here's another one. Paleolithic-era diets were vastly different and likely much healthier than today. So you've got, there are some of these examples are taken from existing populations, but a lot of them are projected back into the past. What's, you got any comments on those?
I refer back to the very first paper that I could track down on the topic of salt was by that Lillian Gleibman, which I quote in the article that I've got on your site. Lillian Gleibman was an anthropologist who said, "Oh, look at what's going on in Japan. Some of those people eat 90 grams of salt a day, and many of them eat 50 grams of salt a day, and they've got this, you know." Most Japanese people die of coronary disease. And so, and when you compare that to the Yamamomo Indians of Brazil, of the jungles of Brazil, they don't have any salt, and their blood pressure is really, really low. But what she fails to mention, of course, is that on average, Japanese people live to something like 89 or 90, while the average lifespan of the Yamamoto Indians is a cracking 29 years.
I thought it varies from 29 upwards. They kill each other all the time as well. Anyway, that's this is crappy people, so-called dietitians, showing how useless they are. What about this business of evidence from several million years ago?
Well, again, the problem for me, Ray, is that, you know, in essence, I don't think evolution is real. My view is that we are created.
Do you think there were no human ancestors a million years ago, or in the Paleolithic?
I don't in any way or shape or form think anything other than the creation story is true. So it's a problem for me to talk about something of.
Well,
of,
there was a.
And in the end. And in the end, all we're interested in is, I think the argument most people would make is, how do they know what it was like a million years ago, even if they're, what they're saying is true?
I was hoping you'd get around to saying that. I mean, there were, in the time of Stonehenge, that was Neo or something, Mesolithic, because they built stuff. What did they eat? I mean, how the hell do people know what they ate? They might have had people taking salt. Right, one of the arguments for ley lines, for lay, is that they had some of these towns ending with witch, like Norwich, were salt towns, and
exactly.
That they had straight line routes to get to deliver the stuff.
In fact, the journals of Julius Caesar on his arrival into the UK when he was to conquer the United Kingdom, the first thing he did, obviously it wasn't the United Kingdom then, but, you know, Britain or whatever it was called in that day, one of the first things he did was to get his salt makers working.
You said that. We ought to say something about trace elements, really. I mean, a lot of people don't even know about these. I see that iodine is sold by that semi-quack chap. I can't remember his name in... what is he? The one in InfoWars. Anyway...
Yeah, so he sells it to prevent you dying from nuclear.
Because, I mean, the stuff is the stuff needed in such minute amounts. But there are plenty of other things. Like molybdenum, for example. I'm told, or remember reading, that molybdenum is short in Australian soils, which is why you can't... You know, the stuff, the vegetation there is rather sparse, particularly in the middle, in the centre of it. So presumably if you've got some molybdenum and ploughed it into vast areas of Australia, you could have crops growing there if you wanted to do that. But a lot of people don't understand these things.
Well, I think there's a whole, agriculture in Australia, if I might say, there is a massive underground water supply in Australia which is totally unexploited. And in fact, it's banned for people
artesian
to exploit
wells.
Them.
Yeah, would they if yeah. they exploited them? Would they level drop? I mean, I remember being told in Rhodesia that they had artesian wells there, but they were getting lower and lower. It's a sort of dubious strategy. That's what they say. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we hear all sorts of things, but not exploiting them results in nothing happening. Yeah. And that's fine, you know, if that's what you want to do, but okay.
Shall we conclude round about now? Okay.
Give me a
summary and add any other anecdotes or whatever that you feel like doing.
Okay, well, I guess in summary,
and also
I would say
could
that
tell us
the,
whether you think you're getting anywhere is another thing.
Whether I'm getting anywhere.
By the way, that website has now had just short of 10,000 views. I'm relying on Nihuo. It's not that easy to, when you spread have a website over a number of years, it's not that easy to total all these things up. But about
you mean the website or the page on
Salt? Oh, I see. Yes, the page on Salt specifically has had about 10,000 downloads. But of course, they might have been copied or stored on memory sticks or something. For all I know, it might be a routine to teach it now somewhere, I just don't know. But give me an overview of where we are now and what the future is and stuff, and where you'll be.
I guess we're now seeing in the media things like why everything we know about salt may be wrong.
Yeah.
We're seeing papers published on the blood pressure article demonstrating that the idea that lower salt results in lower blood pressure is just wrong. It's just false. So again, it satisfies that view that I have, that the more salt you have, the more liquid you have, and the thinner your blood will be.
Yeah.
One little anecdote I will talk about is that the problem with people getting very low salt is that they start to produce high amounts of renin, which they know is a problem for elderly patients. So now they've developed an operation to cut the nerve from the brain to the kidney to produce the renin. And in fact, I know a woman who's had this operation, and it didn't do any good at all, and she's continuing to be in a kind of crazy backwards and forwards going on.
Have you converted
with her blood
converted
pressure
her to eating more salt, or would she not be allowed to?
Or
is it too late?
She loves salt, but she's just completely prevented to do it. You know, her doctors would have a fit. This is a woman that loves salt.
By the way, it's another anecdote. I remember you mentioned this. There's this kind of hydrochloric acid supplement, isn't there? It's called something betaine.
That's right. Betaine hydrochloric acid. Yeah,
really,
I mean,
insane, isn't it? It's just
it is insane.
Is it just a money making thing that they keep going?
No, I'm... the indigestion business is worth a huge amount of money, Ray. It just defies belief. I still hear advertisements every day about, you know, about, you know, take this particular pill to overcome your indigestion.
I suppose you've got to laugh in a way. I mean, the trouble is medicine's been, generally speaking, been so successful that all they can do is have phonies and things sprouting out all over. Anyway, sorry, I was interrupting you there. Any final comments?
I guess my final comment is ask yourself, how does your stomach work? And there's actually, there was a well-known booklet called The Acid-Base Balance in Humans, which I had a copy of, and I unfortunately lost the original, one that I had from about 1960. And when I downloaded a recent one, it was quite different in its approach. But that original Acid-Base Balance book from the sort of 60s was very clear about the importance of salt. And salt and water in the human body go together simply because that's the way we're designed. And the sodium performs a number of incredible functions. The chloride performs a number of incredible functions, and they all go together to make our body work. So probably three of the most important bits that you need to run your body are sodium, chloride, and magnesium, all of which come from sea salt. Potassium comes from your food, and those four basically make up the bits that drive your body.
So you favour a holistic view. That would please people, wouldn't it? Holistic stomach therapy or something.
Well, I'm really just saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's just difficult to get to make it clear, isn't it? It's absolutely essential, vitally important, and cannot be ignored at your peril.
Here are the things that you can tell you that you've got. You're low in salt. First of all, you've got indigestion. Secondly, you've got dry eyes. You've got you drool. You know when you're sleeping, you find yourself drooling. There are some pretty clear indicators that you're low in salt. So if people are experiencing those things, you know, think about
okay.
it. Obviously people are reading the blog, and it links to my own blog where essentially I talk about salt and the importance of sunshine, which again is one of those things that have been just walked away from.
Perhaps you ought to wrap it up. We've got to, rather than sort of fading out. My site is big-lies.org/salt is this particular one, and your one is how to take care of your penis, which doesn't immediately suggest
.wordpress.com.
Although that doesn't immediately suggest a salt connection. And we also should say, as a statement of fact, that you've started up a company making sea salt, which functions in Australia, as
that's
I understand
right.
it.
Yeah, and I've really set that company up largely because I took this is being an important issue, and I wanted to make salt.
Okay,
that was
You're
great.
Seabrite, isn't it? BRITE.
Now the company's called the Australian Flake Salt Company, and the site is www.australianflakesalt.com.au.
Actually, I was going to include a bit at the end, is saying that if anybody benefits medically from this, perhaps they could donate, and my site could always do donations. And I don't suppose Frank would object either.
I'm not.
Anyway.
No, you're welcome. But please send any contributions to Ray.
Suits me.
Anyway,
it's now the 24th of September, and that's released. It is here. I suppose in Australia it's not. Are you the 23rd there?
No, it's the other way around.
No,
we're ahead of you, Ray. It's 9:15 p.m. on the 24th.
Okay. Anyway, enough of that.
I'd like to publicly thank you, Ray, for putting my work out for perusal. It's greatly appreciated. It certainly encouraged me to become more public about this topic, and it wouldn't have happened without your encouragement. Well, and it's greatly appreciated.
Very nice you'd say so. And I'm conversely, I must say the same thing. I just had absolutely no idea that this was a serious issue at all until you pointed it out, and I did a bit of burrowing as well. So we're mutually grateful. And on that note, let's stop now. Good. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Terrific.
Bye.